Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 3 of Mental Illness in Pop Culture. I'm Scott.
I'm Liam.
I'm Joe.
And today we are going to delve into mental health issues as characterized in the Looney Tunes cartoon series. We would like to welcome our guest, Chris Gonzalez. Chris, could you tell us a little about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a student at Northern Illinois University, counselor in training. I have a background in, I was a firefighter for a number of years. I've been a teacher now for 12 years. Basically, this is just trying to start another second career for myself. And quite frankly, is when it comes to mental health and pop culture, I've always been that type to be able to pick and nitpick over the little things that people will say all the time later on. You're ruining it for me. So I figured this would be a really good outlet to be able to do it.
Yeah.
So I was curious when this topic came up, and I know you a little bit, so it seemed like it made sense. But tell us how you got into this. Why this?
To ask that question would be to ask, like, what got me into cartoons? And like most things, it kind of takes you away from reality, right? And I related much more to cartoons than I usually did with real life actors. So just was starting to watch Looney Tunes, Tiny Tunes, been watching The Simpsons since the very first episode, 1989. Been going through the entire 90s, 2000s, so on and so forth with cartoons. And what I'll just tend to notice is I'll notice the little subtle little hints that cartoons will be. Subtle little hints of messages they try to send in cartoons. I chose the Looney Tunes because Looney Tunes are supposed to be the polar opposite of Disney, right? Whereas Disney's very wholesome and old-fashioned American family values, Looney Tunes was always kind of the rebel, where they do things a lot darker, a lot more abrasive, though it's considered pretty tame nowadays. At the era that it came out in, it was considered, this was kind of edgy cartoons. I mean, cartoons weren't normally this. Cartoons were what was associated with Disney. So I started watching it, and as I got older, I started realizing, wow, this is some pretty messed up stuff they're showing us. So they're sending us some nice little hints here. And
gotta love the racist iconography.
Oh my god.
My favorite episode.
Yeah. It's like, well, I was hoping actually that we get into some of that, because with these having come out in a different era, and now we're looking at them through a 2017 lens, I think it'd be interesting to, you know, sort of see to what degree do these cartoons represent the era in which they were created.
I think that's a very good point. It's as you mentioned, it was a different era. A different thought process, a different value system. Whether you think it was right or wrong, it was what it was. It was very different era. So it's like some of the examples we had was has to do with sexism, sexual assault. We have what looks like gender identity issues, issues related to what we deem now what they would deem as cross-dressing. We also have the more deeper aspect, which probably I'm always open for debate for, is the schizoaffective disorder.
Yeah.
So that'll be really interesting.
So I'm curious, you know, what evidence you have for these mental health issues being characterized in these cartoons?
Well, which one would you like to go into first? I mean, we could go to the hot topic of sexual misconduct.
That's a hot topic right now, so let's jump right in.
Well, the one character I think about more than anyone is Pepe Le Pew.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got it bad.
Total sexual predator on so many levels. I mean, he's not only a couple episodes that he knew where she was. He was following, he was stalking her, you know, the female cat. What does he do when he sees her?
He has no boundaries.
None.
He grabs her completely, right?
Absolutely. Starts, you know, rubbing on her, and you're just like, if you look at that now in the context of the modern era, you're like, how did they get away with this? Mm-hmm. I mean, they were essentially were saying, this is okay, and this is funny.
Let me mention this morning, I'm sorry, Joe.
Go ahead.
So I'm watching some of the links that Chris sent to us, and I'm going, how many years ago, when I didn't do that research, did this actually come out? So kind of what you were mentioning earlier. And then I'm like, well, my parents probably thought it was okay, or maybe they weren't really watching it. And then I had this moment of paralysis, literally watching Pepe Le Pew, because I have a 15-year-old daughter. And I'm like, how much were my kids now, 15, 18, you know, within that time span, years ago, really watching this? And then I thought, oh, nope, it was the Disney Channel that they were watching. And then I thought, what if in 10 years we look back at that and it's actually developing these thoughts as well? But I was alarmed as a mom that, you know, how much were they watching of this and just the embedded messaging that we're going to really dive into now. But it was scary for me a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's shocking to look at. And this probably goes, I'm going to lean somewhere probably towards the 50s, 60s.
Yeah.
It's probably that era, so this well beyond me.
Yeah.
But I'm just, it's, I look at it and I'm like, I'm just shocked that this is what they would, and the things, imagine how many times parents would just say, here, watch some cartoons, and they'd leave. So no one's actually watching the kid and watching necessarily, because cartoons in this era was a kid's thing. That was only for children, right? But if adults were to look at it, you'd definitely be leaning forward and saying to yourself, what are my kids watching?
Right.
Or what messages are they getting?
Yeah, Joe.
Bringing up Pepe Le Pew and how Pepe essentially stalks the female cat, and as soon as he sees her, he rubs all over her. I'm sorry, but it made me immediately think of Trump. And
well, thankfully, we don't have the video representation of all that.
I wonder if we can get
Trump
away with it.
Trump was influenced by, you know, as
right,
a younger...
that's his era.
Well, I mean, if you look at his coif and the way his hair is, I mean, it's not too terribly far away from Pepe. And
anybody find it funny there's a relation to Pepe and Pepe the Frog going to Trump?
Yeah. You know, and on top of that, you know, the P word, I'm not sure whether or not I can say podcast.
I don't know. we drop F-bombs once in a while. However, you need to be aware that some people listen to these podcasts as extra credit assignments in their graduate level classes.
Well, since I've said it in class.
Yeah. Right.
No, just kidding. When you have a figure like the President of the United States who makes a comment like, grab women by their genitalia.
Yeah.
And the P word... used to talk about this specific genitalia, and the fact that that same P word is also used to signify a cat.
Yes.
Just
wow.
The absurdity just kind of builds and builds and builds. And it's really interesting that, that you bring this up first, because when I was little, 7, 8, 9 years old, I loved Pepe Le Pew. I thought that his, well, what I perceived at the time as tenacity. You know, he found the love of his life and he's going to do everything he can to obtain the love of his life or the object of his desire.
Yeah. And I defined it that way too.
Yeah, and it's like now to see what he does, it's not funny anymore. Now it's kind of creepy.
Well, and the funny part was that he was a skunk and not realizing, like the offensive part was the odor, not the lack of boundaries and the inappropriate actions.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. Not to mention the fact that he has a thick foreign accent. I wonder if that also kind of factors in.
Right. And so, and that is the American stereotype of French people. That, you know, we think that they don't use deodorant, et cetera.
Over-sexualized.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, wow. I mean, yeah, there's definitely a number of things. And that was a good observation with the cat.
Yeah.
And I was like, I could completely...
Boy, if we could just somehow have recorded the expression on your face when Joe was talking.
About the cat, yeah.
Like, oh, my God, yes. And the way he's petting, I'm like, oh, my God.
We like to have
this is
fun.
Like a red-faced moment in podcast land.
Love ruining childhoods. What can I say?
Yeah.
So the next one, did you want
to... Well, and I just want to say, though, I mean, it's interesting that you start with that. I mean, this week, while we're recording this, has just been... I don't know the right word, but it's just suddenly come to awareness of the prevalence of sexual harassment.
Yeah.
It's like it reached a critical mass all of a sudden after hundreds of years. Suddenly this week, it's all just really exploded.
It's not just sexual harassment, it's sexual assault.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's just, because...
Oh, yeah.
He's not just following her around, catcalling, no pun intended, catcalling her.
Nice.
But, I mean, he's, again, rubbing up on her. I mean, he has, as Leanne mentioned, absolutely no boundaries. No boundaries whatsoever. To him, she is...
Prey,
a plaything. There's definitely the power dynamic is meant to think that it's all in his favor and she needs to run. So I look at that and I'm like, gee, it's what a wonderful story to tell young females.
Right.
Who watch
and
this.
There's no accountability for Pepe. And as you're saying, the responsibility is all on the cat. I mean, it's almost a parallel to when men say that women were asking for it because of how they dressed, etc.
Good point. Which makes me wonder, with the line that always seems to accidentally get on the back of the cat, it's like, oh, well, it was because she had something physically on her.
Yes, yeah.
So she was, well said.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe she was asking for it. Shouldn't have looked a certain way. If she didn't want to be assaulted, don't look a certain way. Don't stand out.
Right.
You know, there's one that I'm remembering in which, you know, I mean, we know how the Pepe Le Pew cartoons go, but there's one episode where she inadvertently falls off a building into a barrel of water. And the water removes the painted stripe on her back, and she's... she's all wet and ragged looking, etc. And she, as she emerges from the water, and Pepe comes around the corner and he's looking for his darling, however his voice sounds, and he sees her. And so she's no longer the object of beauty anymore, you know, and at the same time she sees him. And in retaliation, what does she do? She, like, takes a key and drops it down what would be her shirt, but it's actually under her skin. We know how cartoons work.
Yeah.
And now she turns around and begins to chase Pepe. So it was almost like, you know, and as I'm sitting here remembering that cartoon, it's almost like they're trying to flip the power relationship. And suddenly now she's the aggressor and she wants him, but he doesn't want her, basically because now she's not attractive, you know? And it was just a weird twist. And of all the Pepe Le Pew cartoons I've ever seen, I don't remember any other one in which the female cat shifts her position and becomes the aggressor and the obsessed in the situation. So it was a really odd turn. And it always kind of makes me, now I shouldn't say always, but now that I'm thinking about it, it makes me wonder what they were thinking about in the writer's room as they were, you know, developing the script for the show. Because, I mean, who thinks of that kind of thing, you know?
Do you remember what the motivation in the storyline was? Like, why did she turn and pursue him? Just to get back at him?
Basically, yeah, it was retribution. It was like, now I have power, and I'm going after you. Especially since you don't want my advances anymore, right? Because now you think that I'm unattractive, you know? So it was like this really interesting play on the idea of attraction, the idea of obsession, the idea of power relationships, you know? Cartoons are a lot deeper than we ever take them to be.
Well, so I don't recall that episode, but from your description, on one hand, it sounds like it seems to be normalizing the actions of Pepe Le Pew, like, well, this is what anybody would do. This is what a woman would do if she were in the same scenario. And it also reminds me of, let's say that the cat and Pepe had been in an equal power relationship. It reminds me of the phenomena within relationships of distancer-pursuer, where one person is pursuing, one person is distancing, but then when the pursuer stops pursuing, then the distancer becomes the pursuer, and the pursuer becomes the distancer, which is really fits in with systems theory in couples and family counseling. Yeah, so how about somebody else?
Okay, let's see. Let's go to the golden ring of the Looney Tunes universe, Bugs Bunny.
Okay, okay? Yeah.
No secret, and everyone knows that famous operatic cartoon where he's singing opera with Elmer Fudd and so on and so forth. But there's always a continuing theme with Bugs. He always dresses in women's clothing, right? And I've always wondered, you know, at that era, that was considered, Bugs is man, you're not supposed to be dressed, they're doing it more for laughs kind of thing. But I always wondered, is there an identity issue for Bugs? Or is he just a transvestite? Or are there gender identity issues? Or is there something more underlying? And keep in mind, you never, ever, and that was one thing I always liked about Looney Tunes. Found interesting about Looney Tunes. You never saw partners until later on in the 90s. And you had Bat and everything else.
Yeah.
So I always used to wonder about Bugs. It's like, is Bugs gay?
Right.
Right? And then with the carrot and everything like that, I always used to wonder sometimes, they always used to be
Are you thinking Freudian with that?
A little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and then Elmer would sometimes chase him when he was dressed up as a woman. Mm-hmm. And so I'd always wonder a few times, like, is Bugs gay? So, and then there was an episode that I know Robot Chicken kind of parodied what I'm referencing, where later on it showed that he actually ended up having a gender reassignment. Mm. So it's that, Bugs was, of course, Robot Chicken is entirely parody, right? So if anyone's ever seen it in this episode, Bugs is doing an interview saying, at first I was just doing it just to, get the attention of Elmer to kind of distract him. But then I found myself feeling very comfortable. And then later on, they explain he had a gender reassignment, and Elmer's like, that used to be one. I mean, he used to just like, ooh, yeah. Bugs used to look good.
Yeah.
So I always used to wonder with Bugs, does he, what's going on with Bugs here?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and again, we're looking through a 2017 lens, and this, what you're talking about in terms of gender identity. Something that was never talked about is, it wasn't alive in the 50s, but I don't think that it was. Mm-hmm. And yet Bugs is nothing if not forthright and kind of puts himself out there and frequently is dressing in women's clothing and not limiting to that. I think there's also makeup and possibly hairstyle.
He wears brassieres. I mean, he goes all out.
Well, there's a change of voice to fit the character as well. But sure. Something that stood out for me is that he is very much using the feminine sexuality to interact with all these other male... So what's the pig's name?
Porky Pig.
Porky Pig. And we've got Elmer Fudd.
Yeah. Somebody Sam.
All these.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so in some of the videos that I watched that you had sent... He's being a woman and pretty aggressively sexually flirting with these men. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a power kind of differential going on there. So he's a timid little rabbit. He's not in his character, but he's a rabbit, and rabbits are, characterized as timid little things. All of a sudden he becomes a woman and he's got the power over these people that are kind of after him, that are praying after him. And I saw one of the videos today. I don't know which, if it was Porky Pig or who was after him, but they had a gun after him, and he started dancing on a stage, or there were other people dancing on the stage, and the pig's face turns into a wolf as it's drooling, watching this, you know, feminine representation. And so it's interesting. But he, Bugs gets them all to do whatever he wants, as they think they're chasing this woman, mm-hmm. or they're getting the attention of the woman. Like, that's why he's dressing that way. Or at least that's what the stories represent.
So then in with these characters like Elmer,
yeah.
who are, I mean, Elmer Fudd is trying to shoot Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
But then when Bugs becomes a woman, Elmer has no power right. even over exactly. himself.
Right.
And so that's also characterizing men as having no control over their desire, which in some ways resonates a little bit with what we were talking about with Pepe, that mm-hmm. so there's like a lack of accountability or responsibility.
No self-control, yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder also is because Bugs, when he dresses and acts like, well, he's always purposely over-sexualizing himself.
Right.
Basically telling that, also possibly sending the message to women, if you do this, you can get men to do whatever you want.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was offended in a way because there was such, it wasn't just these, you know, male characters just, you know, literally in some of the scenes drooling, but they also are stumbling over themselves. Like, they really look ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
They look dumb. So it's not just a, oh, I'll do whatever this feminine character now wants. They kind of become blubbering idiots.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it, what's the word,
emasculated?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is negative. Like, it makes men look like they completely lose their mind.
Mm-hmm.
There's no self-control. And their identity is totally gone because a woman walked in the room. It's an ugly representation.
A sexualized woman walks into the room.
Right.
You know, that just is purpose. Again, over embellished bust, long hair, pouty red lips.
Right.
You notice even the walk. Mm-hmm. The walk would always change.
Kind of a sachet.
Right. I don't know if you ever noticed, too, sometimes they would, you can tell in the drawing of the animation, they would widen his hips.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so add more curves to him. So it was one of the, it's like, you look, you're like, wow, they are doing everything they can, aren't they?
Well, they did have him play a lot on images like Mae West and Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
Especially when it came to messing with poor old Elmer Fudd. Which is, I think when they wrap the dressing in drag in that kind of tradition and try to connect it to that, it's this like really, really delicate balance that comedians have to do, because I mean it's an old vaudevillian vaudevillian device, right? Dressing in drag and acting in certain behaviors, you know, to get a laugh. And we still see it, you know. I mean, what, Martin Lawrence basically became a household name,
right?
Through Big Mama's House franchise by dressing in drag. Tyler Perry,
yeah. Jamie Foxx in Living Color.
Drag. Oh,
yeah.
Jamie Foxx with Wanda's character in Living Color. So on one hand, there is this long tradition of men dressing in drag to further comedic goals, while at the exact same time, it is, especially in cartoons, because it's so hyper-realistic,
mm-hmm.
that, or hyper-unrealistic rather, that then hyper-sexualizes the female form and female identity, you know, and necessarily ties women to sexuality and only sexuality. And I think a part of what we're kind of talking around is what kind of lasting impact does that have on children, especially boys and girls for that matter. I'm sorry to be exclusive. I didn't mean to be that way. But number one, how does that have an impact on the ways in which boys construct girls, especially at younger ages, and what girls would allow, so to speak? and at the same time reinscribing these messages for girls about how they ought to be. You know, you want to get the guy, then you're going to act like Marilyn Monroe,
and
right?
Look like this. Chris, I'm curious because this is your interest. Have you done research as far as, you know, the intent of the writers and animators? I mean, have you done any research as far as other people looking at Looney Tunes?
No, I do know that it was not uncommon where rejected writers from Disney would end up going to Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Again, as sometimes they were thought, you're too dark, too whatever, and they just, you know, so basically took, they, Warner Brothers, especially when it came to the Looney Tunes, was like the island of misfit writers. So they took, you know, they were just, they just too edgy. Sometimes, again, Disney was all about wholesome, old school American values. Looney Tunes was more like the working man's cartoon, right? So, again, it was darker tone, edgier animation. If you take a look at the animation, it was even sharper. You know, nowhere near, whereas Disney, if you notice, you'll see a lot of circles in their animation, very round shapes. Looney Tunes, you'll see a lot of sharp shapes. Mm-hmm. So it was a completely different style. But as far as like major research, that's, I haven't really done enough on that one. The only thing I know was that it wasn't uncommon where you get no at Disney, you get a yay at Warner Brothers.
But I, you know, I respect that, and I think that's an important point. However, at the same time, I also don't think that we should lose the fact that Disney, whew, God.
Right.
I mean, I'm almost scared to say anything because, you know, Disney, they don't mind suing people, you know, and Disney has its
not as pure
very
as
fair share.
No, oh yeah,
really sketchy and downright offensive ideas about not only race, especially with the cartoon-like Song of the South, but also the role of women and the construction of female identity, especially.
Oh, yeah.
And they can be quite vicious. Can we drop sources on this? Because, like, it's making me think about this documentary called Mickey Mouse Monopoly.
Oh, yeah.
Where they really analyze the messages and representations in Disney film, Disney cartoon films. And I think a lot of those exact same ideas are strewn throughout the Warner Brothers canon. Hmm. Not as sure about Hanna-Barbera because I stopped watching them when I was like 9 because they were boring.
Maybe it was just a little bit more incognito the way Disney was doing it. I would love to know the Warner Brothers motivation, though, and I will look that up. Like, what are we doing in the 1950s trying to go so far outside of what was, you know, considered appropriate in family dynamics and in the traditional roles of the women and whatever. I mean, it's not that it's so far out, I guess, but so over, you know, I don't know.
No, I get it. And I think when it comes to, because you're right, Disney did do, at their time, I think they thought what they were doing was the wholesome American thing to do. So what they thought was they kind of put themselves on a pedestal. I think the difference between Warner Brothers and Disney on this one is Warner Brothers said, we know what we're doing. We know what we're doing. It's all implied, but wink, wink, we know what we're doing.
Because it's interesting because a lot of people don't even get to see the original cuts of the cartoons anymore.
Right.
They've all been sanitized to remove a lot of the extremely racist iconography and a lot of the extremely sexist iconography.
Yeah.
Although the sexist jokes and iconography is a lot more reduced than it used to be, but still very prevalent because, I mean, they end up being essential parts of the storyline. So an episode in which Bugs Bunny dresses in drag to fool Elmer Fudd, it doesn't make any sense if you no longer see Bugs in drag, right?
Yeah.
So they still have that to deal with. But I know that there were cartoons from the early Warner Brothers canon where all the non-white characters were painted with really dark skin and the big red lips.
Right.
Other ethnic groups and the way that they drew Asian characters were reflective of yellow journalism cartoons. So I mean, they were pretty nasty.
Oh yeah,
and really self conscious about it. I don't know enough though about Chuck Jones compared to Walt Disney. You know, there was recently like a 2-episode documentary on PBS on American Masters about Walt Disney, which was really interesting and revealing. Actually, I think it was American Experience, not American Masters. But I haven't seen anything like that about Chuck Jones, who's the director of a lot of the Warner Brothers cartoons. So it'd be interesting to know how his ideas about the world and his experiences differed from Walt Disney, because Walt's got a lot of dark secrets.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny you mention that, because you ever heard when they talk about the Disney Vault?
Yeah. No.
I know you have. There actually is a Disney Vault. And there was, it was a movie they made. So, I mean, this thing was like the most racist movie.
Song of South.
Yes. That, there is only one copy left in the world, and that literally is in the Disney Vault. They destroyed all of the others.
Wow.
They researched, found them, bought them all, destroyed them, and they keep one copy for historical significance in the Disney Vault. And actually, like a lot of, you know, when they say we're coming now out of the Disney Vault, we're now reissuing that, they reissue it from what they do is they have the originals. They use those, make the copies to go make a certain amount of, let's say, The Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
They put out a certain amount, take the original, and put it right back into the Disney Vault. So that's not like a advertising. There really is a Disney Vault.
Right. A literal vault.
Yeah.
Yeah, where those are stored. Well, one thing I wanted to add as I've thought about this is, you know, because I wondered, you know, when you first talked to me about this idea, but are we like connecting dots that are not connected? But then I thought, you know, the title of something, and we've talked about this on previous podcasts, the title is the shortest possible version of the larger thing. And the title is Looney Tunes, which is a reference to a state of mind, you know, a slang term for crazy, etc. So, yeah, so I think you're on to something, Chris.
Do you want to go to the final one?
So I did a little research while we were sitting
there. Oh, okay.
Sorry, before you do this final one,
I thought you had I a few found more.
The... what did I do with it? I found... you know what? Oh, here it is. On the fandom website, I found a synopsis of the Pepe Le Pew episode that I was talking about earlier. And it's called For Sentimental Reasons. And I'm not going to read the entire review or synopsis, but I want to read this one part to give the listeners a sense of what was happening in this cartoon. First of all, the female cat's name is Penelope.
Yes.
She runs to a window and tries to open it, but it is stuck. She runs away, and Pepe finds her inside a glass cabinet. They mime to each other, Pepe trying to get Penelope to come out, and Penelope refusing, indicating that it is due to his odor. At this point in the original short, Pepe Le Pew pulls out a gun and holds it up to his head, then walks out of Penelope's line of sight. Then the gun goes off, and a panicked Penelope rushes out of the cabinet to Pepe. Pepe says, "I missed, fortunately for you," and begins kissing Penelope Pussycat. These shows
were... My jaw is dropping.
It's like, Scott's mouth is open completely, his jaw's on the floor.
So, I mean, and I guess when I was little, that was funny.
Yeah.
But now, you know, sitting here all these years later... I was like, wow, what kind of...
I mean, that's characteristic. I mean, obsession,
suicide.
Yeah. I mean, that's the type of thing that somebody that has some serious issues is doing.
Yeah, I'm like literally thinking about all of these news reports of someone who snaps and locks typically his family in the house, threatening to kill them, himself, and anyone else that tries to come in, you know.
It also reminds me of individuals who say, if you leave me, I don't know what I'll do, meaning like,
I'll kill myself, you know? So threat of self-harm as a form of manipulation.
Right. And,
yeah.
Matt, what have we done?
All right. Well,
but it's still, and the worst part is that it's still funny. I mean, it really is too bad, because on one hand, it is still funny. And, you know, as we're sitting here having this conversation, I'm thinking back to the one of the first movies I ever saw in the theater in the mid-1970s was the Bugs Bunny movie. The Looney Bugs Bunny movie, I think was his title. And sitting there Saturday mornings and afternoons after school, and I couldn't wait to see the next Bugs cartoon, you know. Or, you know, it's like now I sit for hours and watch reruns of Law and Order. And I think I literally learned that practice from sitting and watching hours of Looney Tunes, you know. So, I mean, it's like such an indelible part of my childhood, but I was completely disconnected from what these larger messages and images were, or how it had an effect on me as I grew into maturity, you know. And, you know, would I let my kid watch that now? My 13-year-old, maybe, you know, but my 4-year-old, no, I don't think I could.
I mean, when I was growing up, so I don't remember, I think you grew up in Michigan?
Illinois.
Okay. So I don't know if you got Channel 9 while you were growing up, and Ray Rayner.
Yeah, definitely.
And he would play Looney Tunes, so it's like 6, 7 in the morning, and I'm watching Looney Tunes cartoons when I'm 5, 6, 7 years old.
Yeah, eating tricks, getting ready to go to kindergarten.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Let's not get into serial cartoons.
You know, I think before this conversation, if you would have asked me, you know, what was the most extreme thing that you remember from these cartoons or that kind of thing, I think that what I would have come up with first is Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner. Is that a good transition for you, Chris?
That is exactly
I'm here
the
for
next
you.
Person.
But that is so extreme. But I wouldn't have thought about Bugs Bunny and his cross-dressing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, I mean, we're not even going to get into Speedy Gonzales.
Well, I think we should. Pokey? Wait, was it?
No, Slowpoke Rodriguez.
Slowpoke Rodriguez, his cousin,
right?
Yeah.
So you're gonna love that one. So right now, though, we got Wile E. Coyote. He's
well.
Next
I'm
on the
curious
list.
Though. So when you say the most extreme, Leanne, Wile E. Coyote, what are you thinking is extreme?
Oh, I mean, what the anvil falls on their head and their pancakes, and they jump up and go get each other again, and running into walls, and you know the Roadrunner can paint a tunnel onto the side of a Mesa and go right through it, and Wile E. Coyote can. I mean, these are just, and I haven't watched any of those videos, so that's just what I have in my memory. But you know, it was so violent and extreme.
It was.
But I didn't consider, you know, what we've talked about to this point. That is not in my memory as issues. So when I say extreme, I think I'm talking about my 5-10-year-old version of what was extreme in my experience.
So speaking of Wile E. Coyote, though, let's talk about some characteristics about Wile E. He's a coyote. He seems pretty isolated out there in the desert, right? I'm guessing somewhere in the Southwest, if anyone's ever been in the Southwest, get really hot, not much water.
Dehydrated.
I think Wile E. Coyote has schizoaffective disorder. And I'm saying it for this reason. You ever notice, like you said, when he'll paint something on the wall, like a tunnel, a train tunnel, he'll see the Roadrunner go right through it. When he does it, he hits the wall. He'll paint, he'll do something with train tracks. He'll paint like train, whatever. The Roadrunner will stop, train will go by, or nothing will happen, and all of a sudden he gets hit by a train. I don't think the Roadrunner's real. I think the Roadrunner is entirely a concept within his own head. Because when it actually deals with things that are real, like a brick, like a wall, reality sets in.
And but in his own stays, head. It stays permanent.
Oh, that's deep. I'm like 47 and I've never, ever thought of that idea.
Good job, Chris.
Thank you. But it's also like it's years and years of isolation. Yeah, that's why they say like, and when you're people, those who are incarcerated, they have a certain amount of time for solitary confinement because the mind starts to go.
Right.
He's had how many probably years out there in the desert alone by himself? I think because he's constructed something in his own head just to be able to give him something to wake up to in the morning. Something to do.
That's amazing.
Well, I don't think the Roadrunner is real, though. I think it's all, not to mention rope.
Where does that, you know, fuzzy, nicely groomed, beautiful bird come from out there? Do Roadrunners look like that? Are they in the Southwest?
No,
they're actually kind of tiny.
They're like,
they're like little tiny.
They're really low to the ground. They're not tall like the, like Roadrunner. They're really short. Right.
Even in comparison to what a coyote is, it's nowhere near, because the units are about the same height,
right?
Nowhere near as big. And there's just too many instances as well where sometimes, I think he also sets up his contraptions to fail and not even realize it. You ever notice like they always seem to backfire on him? I think he's setting him up to fail and not even realize it. Which is why they always end up backfiring. Because these things, he's following the directions to a T, right? Mm. Yeah, they always show he's got it.
As provided by the Acme.
As provided by Acme. And yet, they always seem to backfire.
So where does he get the money?
That's another question. I don't think it's real either. He has no money.
That's awesome.
Where do these trucks go to exactly? I don't think those trucks are real. I don't think the contraptions are real.
Right? Where do they go?
Right. How does he get mail if he doesn't have a house? No.
At least Bugs Bunny lives in a hole. While he's out there and it's like, he's schizoaffective disorder. That's what I'm going to lean towards on him. Oh, okay. The Roadrunner is not real.
Well, okay, so I'm not ready to let go of this yet.
Okay.
So, I'm a runner, and I have experienced dehydration at times, and you do hallucinate when that happens, so that would make sense in the southwestern desert. And I'm wondering, though, I've never contemplated any of this, but including the self-destructive tendencies. So what would Wiley's motivation be for setting himself up?
Isolation can be a bitch.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and we talked about this a little bit, is I think I'm a firm believer, this is just my own personal beliefs now, everyone looks for purpose.
That's exactly the word that came to mind when Scott said that. I'm like, it's purpose. I don't know about setting yourself up to fail, but this game that he's playing, and that just might be a part of it, but I mean the Roadrunner and all of it, that's purposeful. What's he going to get up and do? Go try to find food that's not there?
Pretty much.
Water that's not there?
So it's like it gives him a reason to live.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And were he to succeed in destroying this imaginary Roadrunner,
mm-hmm.
he would no longer have purpose.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
But maybe some of the stuff that comes back on him and hurts him is not intentional. Maybe that's just a part of, you know, his mental status.
It's kind of a byproduct.
At the time. That's like a symptom of what's actually happening in his world. But the Roadrunner is definitely the purpose.
Well, I do wonder if he might have some self-injurious tendencies.
I wonder if his quote, failures are part of the purpose where it makes him keep trying. Where, yes, not only did, but it also gives him purpose to build something, make something new, that kind of thing, and try something new. I mean, he could just run after the Roadrunner the entire time. But no, he gives himself added layers to actually do something what he feels productive towards the end goal.
Yeah. And I'm curious, so you're saying schizoaffective,
uh-huh.
and could you say something about the affective part of that?
Oh, I mean, I'm not the best at this one. I don't know, I was just reading through the DSM, and I was like, okay. It just sounds like, I mean, I really don't know what to say on that one. It's just,
sure.
this just fit the bill on a number of different levels. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think there's definitely some level of dehydration and exhaustion right. going on as well. But it just never seems to end for him.
Right.
This is a continuing, ongoing, lifelong thing, apparently, for him. Even in the later canon of the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, he's still chasing him to some degree.
Now, what's this later canon of which you
see? Just, you know, when you see, like, the later renditions of the Roadrunner and, you know, like, the
mean,
more
like
modern...
newer shows?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, although very seldom do they use him anymore. They use more Wile E every now and then, when rather, and they're more, like, side characters. Like, if they need a contraption made, they go to Wile E. Coyote. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But that's about it, because I guess it just got played out with, I mean, how many times can you finally chase an imaginary figure in the desert?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it kind of, you know, like on Saturday Night Live, sometimes, you know, some of the characters, they're basically a one-joke character.
Right.
It's still funny, though.
You get a lot of traction?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like a catchphrase.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, why spend, you know, $1 million producing another cartoon that ultimately has the exact same jokes and the exact same storyline as the hundred cartoons that came before it? You know, you might as well just go ahead and reach back into the vault, to use that language, and re-air the old ones.
Yeah.
You know, sanitizing it a little bit, of course, for today's taste, but still, it's easier to edit something out rather than just build it from scratch, even if you're basically recycling the same storyline.
And I know, Chris, you had one other character, or...
I'm stuck on the Beckett right now. I got I'm just thinking about how, like, he's always, he's one moody bastard.
Yeah.
He's very moody. Yeah. He fails. I mean, he gets really either down on himself or he's really pissed.
Yeah. I mean, he certainly is
a lot of obsession
emotional
too.
Roller coaster.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Process that. Do you want to move on to the next one?
Sure, yeah.
Let's go probably to the more blatant, probably racist character that's probably out there within the Looney Tunes universe, and that's Speedy Gonzalez.
Okay.
I'm a firm believer, and this is going to sound real, and I'm only using this conjunction with his cousin, Slowpoke Rodriguez. I'm a firm believer that Speedy's on coke and Slowpoke Rodriguez is on weed. One is just way too chill, and no one has that much energy like that.
Yeah.
And it's always like that spur, like instant, like hardcore.
Yeah.
And I just, it's, there's just. I don't remember
a lot about the storylines that take place. I remember the characteristics, kind of slow motion for me, and then Speedy.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember, like, is there a storyline that kind of repetitively happens? Like,
it's
usually
with Sylvester. What a surprise, Cat and Mouse, right?
Yeah.
And,
I'm sorry, for the record, Sylvester is freaking hilarious. Please continue.
But it's usually just whatever it is that he's just always trying to chase him for whatever reason. I think that was one of the ones I did appreciate about whenever they had Speedy Gonzalez, is I knew the storyline was going to be somewhat different each time. Like, he wasn't just trying to chase, like, a regular piece of cheese. Normally that was it, but it usually be something along the lines, or maybe it was, I remember one, it was a border crossing one.
Yeah.
That was funny. And of course Sylvester was like a border patrol agent, right? But in many cases, every time, it's just usually he's just trying to get some, whatever it is, cheese, or what, he's just sometimes randomly trying to chase me and noise him, what have you, that kind of thing. But I've always felt that Speedy looks like he's on coke.
Yeah.
And his cousin's just really toking it hard.
So, and you prefaced all of this about Speedy and Slowpoke by talking about the most blatantly racist.
Mm-hmm.
So, what's racist about
the Speedy? Sombrero? The kind of like Slowpoke is considered like pretty lazy.
Okay,
right, just always chilling out there, not really doing much. the little bandana. He's got the, he has the Pancho Villa look.
Mm. Oh, like the bandoleros?
Yeah, the bandoleros and everything. Yeah. He's always, I mean, he's got like the whites on there with the red sash. You know, very stereotypical Mexican at the time.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, oh boy. And he's completely broken English, you know, and then the andale, arriba, you know, that kind of thing, you know. And I'm just like, oh boy, it's Speedy. Oh, man. I mean, don't get me wrong. He's funny. But it was like, geez, Speedy, you ain't helping out, man.
It says that Speedy first appeared in 1953. However, the first official version is in the episode called Speedy Gonzalez that premiered September 17th of 1955. So I'm kind of wondering what's the origin story of this character? You know, why, you know, what were the underpinnings of why create particular mouse when he's clearly based on a number of stereotypes about you know, Mexicans. And I don't know. I don't have any proof for this, but my hunch is that we're starting to see the beginning of, you know, we're a year before 1954 and the Montgomery bus boycott, the shift in civil rights relations, and the ways that the general American public was beginning to change its ideals about African Americans, and as well as beginning to challenge Mexican immigration and making sure that it was harder for Mexicans to immigrate into the United States. So this kind of character, you know, ultimately, you know, on one hand, I think they would try to argue that, you know, but Speedy is, he's progressive and he goes after what he wants and he's always, you know, outsmarting or, you know, outpacing the competition, i.e. Sylvester.
Yeah.
Who ends up being the archetype for, you know, the quote-unquote white guy.
Right.
You know,
I'm so, looking at this. You know what Sylvester's name used to be? I completely forgot this. What Sylvester's name used to be called from by Speedy? El Gringo Pussycato.
Oh. Mm.
Yeah. That's a gag. Not even gato.
Yeah. And, you know, and the thing about the character of Speedy is, I think maybe more than any other Looney Tunes character has entered into our lexicon just as a term that we use, like, wow, what a Speedy Gonzales. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't say, wow, what a Bugs Bunny or wow, what a Daffy Duck. I mean, you could, but it, I mean, I'm sure that I myself have used that.
Mm-hmm. It's just, it's a little disclosure, that was my nickname when I was a kid in elementary school because I was always running really fast.
Oh, well, it makes sense.
But yeah, it's used like as a, it's used.
I mean, it's not like even derogatory. It is. It's like a compliment.
It's like fast.
Hey, Speedy Gonzales, good job.
Yeah. And all Asians are good at math, right?
Well, and it is interesting because it goes against, in my thinking, it's going against stereotype, which Slowpoke Rodriguez would be totally going with stereotype of.
That's what I was thinking too.
Yeah. The slowness, laziness, etc.
Mm-hmm. Usually when you first see him, he's got the hat down.
Right.
Sitting on the side doing nothing, that kind of thing.
Doesn't he have like a blade of grass coming out or something?
Yeah.
No, there's a
Yeah.
Slowpoke first appears in 1959. So
it's a little later.
There you go. Mm.
I gotta love the thick accents they had too. The stereotypical, really thick accents.
Well, keep them coming, Chris.
Okay. You want to do? Let's. I'm trying to think of another. Ooh, here's an interesting one. Well, we could keep on the We could keep on the subject of racism, or we can go to another political one. Firearms.
Let's stay on racism for now.
Foghorn Leghorn.
I say.
Yes.
He's hilarious.
He calls everybody boy and son.
Yes.
I mean, he is such a condescending, just what is it? Inferiority comp. I mean, this guy calls. He just talks down to everybody, and he has the standard Colonel Sanders kind of thing going about him.
Yeah.
Right. And
he's a chicken too.
He's a chicken, but that thing—is it just me or do those like coops look like plantations?
Yes.
Oh yeah. Well, the thing he is portraying racist tendencies, and yet the character himself is a stereotype of a Southern good old boy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The good old days. Yeah. Quote the good old days, right? But it's I was.
Well, that's cool, right? Whatever. The problem is that he's always successful in his cartoons.
Oh.
He's the main character. Uh-huh. He doesn't. He's not like a Wile E. Coyote type character, for example. Because no matter, everybody's heart ultimately is with Wile E. You know, we're rooting for him to win for the most part.
Yeah,
you know, we're rooting for him to get the Roadrunner at least once so he can eat. You know,
just get him.
And maybe all those delusions will stop, right? But Foghorn, he is always the alpha in his cartoons, and he always has the ability to get the girl, you know, because he's always kind of running after that one really scrawny chicken.
Yeah.
And the only time he ever really gets bested is when he's dealing with. The little chicken.
Tweety?
Not Tweety. No, there's a few episodes where the lady chicken has a son who's really smart. He has a huge head.
Yeah.
And wears these little tiny John Lennon-like spectacles.
Yeah.
And he's walking around with books and so on and so forth. And Foghorn's trying to get him to be a man or, you know, be more like a man.
Right. I forgot about that.
And I forgot about it too, and this is all coming back in Stream of Consciousness.
Wow!
This is how many times we watch this these things,
impressive.
Right?
Yes.
You know, it's like none of us really did a whole lot of research for this show, but we're able to sit here and talk about these things without having seen them.
Just spew it right off.
Right.
Yeah.
You know? And so Foghorn's character, as racist as it was, he was still, there was no repercussion to anything that he did because he ultimately was typically the smartest guy in the room, especially if he was messing around with that crazy dog that was on the farm.
I'm wondering if that's a representation because he had that such a strong presence pretty much as a Southern white male.
Yes.
If because they wanted to portray that he was going to win, like he always knew best. Do you see what I mean on that? Like he always knew best. He always won. He always not got the girl, but you know,
yeah,
things always worked out for him. And it was always because of his ideas. He always knew what was best. And I wonder if that was kind of like a subtle little hint at all.
See, now I want to know more about the Fritz Freleng and Chuck Jones and Mel Blanc and the team of people that made these cartoons possible. Where were they coming from? I mean, there's enough research about Walt. Everybody knows that Walt was a flaming racist. We know that.
Maybe we should come back later in the season because this is some intentionality. Revisit. There's a lot of characters with a lot of stuff going on. Yeah. Where did it come from? What is it?
Yeah, like why
is this stuff
was
that was historically
funny?
Going on in the day?
Well, like your
so extreme?
Question, kind of your meta question of like, how does this function? What purpose does it serve? You know, and I had not put together the timing of Speedy Gonzales in 1953, just as we were about to experience a time of racial tension when people of color were seeking civil rights and equality.
He appeared first in 1946.
Foghorn Leghorn.
Wow. And that's the other thing, you know, at least for our generation, I was born in 1970.
Yeah.
And so when these cartoons first came out, I knew they were reruns. And of course, as I got a little bit older, I understood that they were shorts that were screened before films.
Right.
But I think I never really had a sense of exactly when these cartoons actually debuted. So it's almost like they kind of get lost in time because, you know, they're animated characters and animation can play with the idea of time and context. And so, you know, having this conversation right now and thinking back to when I was 8 years old in 1978 and not really having any idea about the first Foghorn Leghorn film coming out
30 years
previous, right after World War II, when there was at the time, if we're going to, you know, use this to talk about race to some degree, returning GIs, black GIs in the South
who
couldn't sit at lunch counters,
right.
you know, and so there's this character that becomes really popular in the American imaginary that has, as we pointed out, this particular stature and uses words like boy and son to
he's
refer
the biggest
to everybody.
He's
so late.
Yeah, and he's such an imposing figure. And of all colors that they could choose for a rooster, he's white too.
Yes.
I mean, literally. So it's like, you know, this notion, I think, you know, when I first heard the topic, it was like, all right, I can, you know, mental health and Looney Tunes. And, you know, it kind of got me to wonder, how do these aspects of oppression and visual oppression further through Looney Tunes, how does that shape the way that we think about mental health,
and
how we connect the experiences of oppression and mental health? And being a black kid growing up in Midwestern Illinois and watching these cartoons over time, you know, what did that do to shape the ways in which I see the world? Or at least how did it have some kind of impact? Because clearly it did. Because there's no reason in hell why I should be able to, like, not have seen a cartoon for 30 years and then I can just
come up with these
spit
characters.
It right.
Right.
It's really strange.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was about it on my Foghorn. And I want to put it on the record. I hated Foghorn Leghorn. I've always hated that douche. I cannot stand him.
I mean, how do you feel about it?
Huh? I've always hated him. He's the primary candidate as far as I'm concerned. Just put him in about a boiling oil and have him for dinner, because I've always hated Foghorn Leghorn. Always hated him.
We could probably spend an entire episode. We'd have to watch him again, but discussing his woman's son.
Yeah.
Just the interactions with that little chick that had the glasses and the, because he was always trying to man him up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Why is your face in the little boy? You know, whatever. Yeah. It was just constant.
He was a bully.
Yeah.
There was something that. I mean, he's right. He's in charge. Large and white and in charge. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what? That's a good way of putting it. You know, large, white, and in charge. I like that.
Yeah. Except for his neck, which was
brown.
I thought it was red.
Reddish brown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like now I need to see a picture of Foghorn. It's so great that we have the internet.
Yeah.
Of course, Daffy, or not Daffy, Porky has a speech impediment.
Yeah.
That's no secret, but that's a pretty simple one.
Yeah, and Sylvester.
Sylvester has a major speech. You can even say Tweety even has something where... I always wonder that if he had a stroke.
Tweety?
Yeah. He always repeats himself. I thought.
He did.
So I always wondered, did he have a stroke? Because he sometimes has a hard time, like, relaying the message out. So I always wonder with him. Yeah. But I know with the next one, the final one that I had in mind was, it went back to Elmer and Yosemite Sam.
Yeah.
I've always felt that they were subtly representatives of the NRA. Everywhere they go, they're carrying around firearms. They don't go anywhere without their firearm. Matter of fact, that's their baby.
So there's that certain mentality. And I, you know, again, because these were created prior to our generations, I don't know what the mentality was at the time of creation. I know now in 2017, people love their guns. I mean, we mentioned Freud earlier, and so some people would feel like you're taking away their identity if you took away their gun.
That would actually be, because remember, Elmer is all about his rifle. He's, I mean, his identity is associated with his rifle. He's
well, a hunter. And it's about, yeah, it's about hunting, and it's about providing for, and it's kind of that male position of, so yeah, I think it's an extension of that. Right. The gun is, that's what gets that done. That's what validates that identity, right?
Right.
That he can do it with
and
that weapon.
Right. And in Yosemite's instance, he's more like, it's a status of manhood.
Mm-hmm.
Where if he doesn't, he's not hunting anything. Instead, he's firing at the ground, he's firing up in the air, he's firing all over the place, kind of like showing his machismo.
He's almost like a Ted Nugent type.
Yeah, with his whole, with the big mustache and the beard and everything like that. Yeah, I could see, definitely. I mean, he was more the representative of prototypical manhood, and then Elmer was more the representative of self-sustaining yourself.
Okay. Oh, right.
Hunter-gatherer.
Mm-hmm.
And using firearms as both the conduit between the two. Like, this is what you firearms bring, this manhood and a self-sustaining male.
Yeah. Well, almost like, you know, those militia groups that they want to get off of the grid and live off of the land and just be entirely autonomous.
So, yeah, that was about it. That's my Looney Tunes one. I could go into other cartoons easily, but
fun. I think we could spend 8 hours on any of those characters. It's really great to just dive a little deeper into and consider stuff that, again, maybe haven't even viewed in 20, 30 years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at Rick and Morty. You know we're going to be taking it, although they don't make any secret about
it.
They don't try to hide.
I'm going to be sick for that one.
30 years from now, I can only imagine what's actually coming out, not so much as what's where we look back and go, oh, wow, look what they put out.
Well, without getting into a major discussion, since you mentioned Rick and Morty, could you just say what you see there, but you don't really need to
real quick what I see is a lot of family dynamics issues that go on, a lot of trauma that goes on, whether it's on Rick's side, Morty's side, Beth's side, Summer's side, a lot of narcissism, a lot of denial, a lot of depression.
Substance abuse.
A lot of substance abuse. There's some political aspects in there. Not too much. It's usually pretty good at trying to stay away. They kind of would stay within their own world on that one. But I've always felt that part of the reason Rick, and this is just my own theory, there's a lot of theories out there when it comes to the Rick and Morty universe.
Oh, okay.
I've always felt that the reason why the Rick that we watch on that show, and he says all the time, I'm the Rickest of the Ricks, right? Is I think he's the Rick that's aware that he's a TV show, which is why he says nothing matters.
Interesting.
So he's the only one that's aware that he knows he's a TV show.
Because
all the other ones seem to care to some degree, you know? But because he knows all the time, that's why he says the universe does, you know, you're really not in control of anything. Meaning that he's aware that since he's a cartoon, he has no real decisions in anything. And he's just the one that knows. He's the Rickest of the Rick because he knows he's not real.
That is really interesting.
And it's the most extreme.
Postmodern.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, this discussion went many directions that I had not anticipated. Wow. Thanks, Chris.
No problem.
I do have a question for Chris. Are you familiar, well, for everybody, are you familiar with the Sylvester and Tweety Bird cartoon Birds Anonymous?
I am not.
Birds Anonymous, so when it opens, Sylvester is chasing Tweety, of course, and he catches Tweety and then pulls the shades to, you know, because he's getting ready to eat Tweety. But then someone stops him, another cat stops him. I think shoots him in the mouth with the plunger. I love that device. And then the new cat comes in and he basically tells Sylvester that he has an addiction to Tweety Birds and that he should go to Birds Anonymous.
Oh, wow.
And so Sylvester goes to this, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous type program for birds and decides to give up birds. And I think the line was, birds are strictly for the birds, is what he says. And so then he goes home and he sees Tweety, and now he has insomnia and he's doing everything that he can to avoid trying to have contact with the bird. Mm-hmm. But because he's now going through withdrawal, he can't sleep, he's got the sweats, he can't eat, the whole nine, you know, every time everything he hears on the radio is a song about a bird, you know, and it all just builds and builds and builds until finally he can't deal with it anymore, and he tries to get Tweety again. And the guy comes back, and he's like, you're just suffering the symptoms, they'll pass, birds are our friends, we can have relationships with birds. And so the second cat starts kissing Tweety on the forehead and relapses himself.
I remember that part.
And so the final joke is Tweety saying, once a bad putty tat, always a bad putty tat. And it's such, and I literally just remembered it here, and I looked it up too, because I didn't know all the particulars, but that episode always kind of stuck in the back of my mind as, you know, kind of a slight against the notion of addiction and the kind of work that Alcoholics Anonymous and other support groups actually offer. Because at the end of the cartoon, the final salvo is, well, once an addict, always an addict, in the sense that you're always going to be irredeemable. Not necessarily you're always going to have to struggle with this, but you're always going to be irredeemable. And so it was a really interesting episode. And on one hand, it was kind of cool because it was showing real aspects of dealing with addiction, you know, and the kinds of symptoms that can manifest through withdrawal. But at the same time, it kind of undercuts all of that by saying there's something clearly that's wrong with you. You know, you have some kind of, you know, negatively associated problem.
When you started telling the story, though, of Sylvester, you know, being advised that he should go get help for this thing. So I don't really know if this is true, but I guess it is. I mean, cats and birds, it's a bit of the circle of life, right? You know, when we don't have Meow Mix to put out, cats still survive.
Yeah.
There are mice and birds involved in that, and I have a farm cat. I see this often. But so I was thinking, as you began to tell the story, before it got to that addiction piece, that really someone was coming in and telling Sylvester how he shouldn't actually be himself.
Yeah.
So I kind of went that direction with it, and then it became this substance abuse thing. But so basically he goes about trying to do what he's told he's supposed to be and do, and then he has these symptoms. And of course you can't get the bird off your mind when you're physically, you know, overtaken by the reality of not getting to be yourself. So there's alternate perspectives there for sure. Huh. It goes deeper when he gets to, you know, the equivalent of an AA thing, but
I also want to point out, though, Tweety pissed me off, too, because he was always kind of a sadist. I felt so bad for Sylvester all the time. He enjoyed watching him suffer a little bit too much.
Passive-aggressive.
Yeah.
I always loved Sylvester. That was my boy. My favorite.
You were going to bring him back.
My favorite is when Sylvester and Porky Pig have to sleep in the haunted house. Oh, and Porky doesn't realize that it's haunted, but Sylvester does. I'm so sorry. But that episode is funny, and it is available on YouTube.
Well, let's wrap up this episode. And so, again, thanks, Chris. And I want to say to everybody, thanks for listening. You can find us on iTunes or your app of choice. Mental Illness in Pop Culture. We are also available on Facebook. We have all of our episodes are available at podomatic.mentalillnessinpopculture.com, and we are on Twitter, MCMINPC. So next week, we haven't decided what we're going to be focusing on. I'm thinking it might be The Room or the Stanford Prison Experiments or something else. And I hope that everybody tunes in then. Any final words, anybody?
Bleep, bleep, bleep. That's all, folks.